Hello and welcome to Is This Just Fantasy, the Book Club, where every week two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a very scary novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the man watching him in the middle distance, all garbed all in black, Duncan Nickel.
And that was the sound of me opening a can of vodka. This episode of Is This Just Fantasy is brought to you by Pink Lemonade Vodka, because it's been a very stressful week.
Just be clear that it's not an official endorsement, but Geordie does like it.
Give me the monies, or just send me a bunch of E's. I'm about to have some more stressful weeks coming.
Ah, Geordie, it has been a stressful week. There's been a lot going on for us. In fact, this episode, the recording of this episode got delayed. I had a very stressful moment where my faithful Blue Yeti, after 2 years of use and me pulling out the connecting wire to my laptop time and time again, finally gave up the ghost on me.
The ghost, you say? You're saying that your microphone, which was so dear to the podcast, died a tragic death. Well, what did you do after that, Duncan? How did you move on?
I mourned it for a solid hour, and then I went and brought another one. Because, you know, these things are replaceable.
I'm going to tell you this, Duncan. There is no doubt in my mind that your old microphone is going to come back, murder your new microphone, and try and take its place.
Do you know what? If it could work while doing that, I don't mind.
Duncan, the last thing you will record will be your screams!
I think that's going to end up happening anyway, mate. But I am very happy. This new one, I think, I just want to say, I'm very delighted with just the general quality, because I went quite cheap. I went second hand. It even said, like, you know, not very good quality, condition okay. And I was like, oh God, what am I getting into? But genuinely, for what ultimately was half the price of the original brand new one that I brought, like, it has the tiniest scratches around the screw holes and otherwise is, like, in perfect condition. I'm actually delighted with this.
I will be the decider of that when it comes to the editing booth, Duncan.
That is very fair. I did have to reset all my gain levels and volumes and all of that, and I am a little bit terrified. I've matched what the old... I literally held them both next to each other. Okay, get all the knobs pointing in the same direction. Okay, That should be good.
Yeah, right now we have listeners across the world clutching their ears with blood streaming down their heads as Duncan's voice booms in their ears.
Talking of listeners, actually, and before we get into the main content of this podcast, I do actually want to give a shout out to one of our brilliant loyal listeners on Instagram, Titanium Pip, for actually pointing out to me a really good way to get this book. Apparently, when we announced at the end of the last one, they jumped on Instagram to let me know that it was currently just 99p on Kindle. Which saved me the stress of going through the library system. So thank you.
Thank Much you, Titanium Pip. You have helped make this somewhat delayed episode happen.
But let's not delay it any longer. Let's get into our kind of our format points. Geordie, it's been a bit longer. Have you been reading, watching, enjoying any other fantasy you'd like to share with us?
Oh man, I had a big list of stuff which I wanted to cover. Because I have been doing a lot of stuff, but I genuinely have just forgotten it all. I'm going to be totally honest. I've had a really crappy day.
So sorry to hear that, man.
And I'm going to channel that anger into this book because it's shit. But I will just say one thing. To go with the format of the show, I did read some fantasy and I enjoyed it because I listened to the audio drama of The King of Swords, the last part of the original Corum trilogy by Michael Moorcock.
Oh, awesome.
I almost said Morpurgo there. It was awesome, actually. It was genuinely really good, and I had a nice experience of reading it, because previously, Duncan, I have read Elric and The Vanishing Tower. And you know what shows up in the Corum, The King of Swords?
The Tower?
The Vanishing Tower. Actually, Duncan, I've forgotten. How much Corum have you read?
Oh, completely none. Once I finished Elric, I moved on to Hawkmoon, was the second kind of Moorcock character that I've gotten into.
Well, Hawkmoon shows up in this.
Awesome.
And he's all over the place, in fact. He's, like, fighting, like, motorcyclists, I think, with, like, animal head helmets. It seemed really badass. And there's always talk about, like, the rune staff and stuff. He has this, like, metaphysical journey through the multiverse where he keeps running into his different incarnations of the Eternal Champion. And in Elric and the Vanishing Tower, Elric shows up, you know, he's on this adventure, and suddenly Corum is there. And you're like, oh, Corum's back. I remember him from Sailors of the Sea of Fate. Oh, and Eric Kosei too. It's weird that you guys don't remember meeting each other. And then that whole adventure, which is like right in the middle of the Sleeping Sorceress, really feels off kilter and weird and like a distraction. And I'm like, I don't like this story at all. It's so weird that Elric just gets pulled away from his own quest to like help out these other versions of himself whom he's never met. And then that exact story plays out almost beat for beat from Corum's perspective. And then you're like, oh my god, Michael Moorcock is a genius. Of course, yes, it's perfect. I it all fits together now.
Moorcock does not get enough credit for establishing multiverses of characters. And like what you've just described, all I can think of is like, yes, it's like the Marvel World Event format. You're reading your your Venom comic and all of a sudden Dark Elves invade the world and you're like, what is this? This is bizarre. But then you get one of those world events from like your character's perspective and you're like, this slaps. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is done perfectly.
Anyway, I really liked it. And it's a fantastic moment where Corum like witnesses the end of Stormbringer, like from the outside, and it is genuinely good. When Elric shows up in the story, and like for the first time, you're like, "Oh my god, this is so cool! I forgot how cool Elric is, but now I have a hero." Thinking like, "Damn, I wish I was as cool as that anti-hero."
Now you've just made me feel like I need to start Corum. I kind of want to finish Hawkmoon first, but. Does it matter? I could go between the two.
Listen, Duncan, I strongly encourage you to finish Hawkmoon first because I feel like together, much like the Eternal Champion, we are two or one. And we should have different experiences that form the wider network.
I want that to be part of our intro now. You should say, this is a fantasy podcast brought to you by your host,
the two who are one.
Brilliant. No, I don't want to be sued. Michael Moorcock's already had so much stolen from him already. Anyway, that is the main thing I read and enjoyed this week. Duncan, what about you?
I did read something and it wasn't nearly as probably as fulfilling as what you read. So the book that we kind of went over, The Woman in Black, is a ghost story, and I don't deal great with ghost stories. It got me a little stressed. It got me a little jumpy at points. So I wanted something really comfy. Something that was like very non-threatening, where I knew where it was going. So I read a Star Wars novel again. It wasn't even one of the like the renowned
Duncan,
ones.
Duncan, there are ghosts in those.
Geordie, I read the novelization of The Force Awakens.
Okay. That's an interesting choice. Geordie,
I didn't even read the adult version. I read the junior, for like, ages 11 to 13 version. I don't know why. It was easy, and it was there.
This is the first time in the entire history of the podcast, but I regret that we don't film ourselves to, like, put ourselves on YouTube. We're just talking to our microphones, because the look I'm giving right now, I really don't know if I can express exactly how I feel. That feels like an unforced error on your behalf.
It was, to be fair. It was somewhat. I brought the book in a, like a jamboree sale, and I didn't realise it was like the junior version. In fact, I didn't realise it was the junior version until, one, I was 90 pages in and I was halfway through. And then I went on forums and people started talking about, I think it's Alan D. Foster who wrote the adult version. And there's someone who wrote the Alien novelisation. They wrote some of the classic Star Wars books. And I was just like, this doesn't feel like his work. This just doesn't seem right.
Yeah.
And so I flicked to the front page. And
yeah, and Duncan,
it's like, oh, Michael Cogg.
The only thing I know about the Force Awakens novelization from way back in the day was learning that there is a scene which didn't make it into the movie but is in the book, which often happens with Star Wars novelizations, where Chewbacca rips the arms off Simon Pegg's, like, alien merchant character. So you miss out on, like, the one thing that you get from the Force Awakens novelization. Because I'm pretty sure that probably wasn't in the junior version.
It was not in the junior version. I do want to say there are some, like, little tidbits which are still very enjoyable. You know, aspects of world building, things like, I'm trying to think off the top of my head now. There's some scenes with the character Finn, who's a stormtrooper. And you actually get him at the very start of the book. He's with a squad of fellow stormtroopers, and you get a little scene of them going through like a training scenario. So you kind of get like him bonding with the stormtroopers before he eventually turns. And that was actually really cool to have in there, you know, humanizing them. So I think the film didn't quite hit.
I mean, I disagree. I think like one of the things that the Star Wars sequels are now quite a controversial topic to discuss, but I think one of the things that it really succeeded at in a subtle way is Finn's introduction and the bloody handprint of like a comrade being shot and then him pulling off his mask. That 1-2 punch, I feel like, is sort of the masterstroke of the early parts of that movie. But that's just my opinion.
Well, if you ever want to know who that guy was, what his name was, his relationship to Finn before the event, this book's got you covered. And other little tidbits like the stormtrooper that fights Finn when Finn uses his lightsaber later on in the film, it's shown that he was part of that squad as well, and he was also at the desert village in the opening scene.
That sucks. That sucks. This is garbage, and I hate that you told me these things.
Well, I had fun. It was a bit of levity, something that I needed after reading The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. Geordie, you've kind of given away your thoughts already. Do you want to expand on them a little bit
before
we dive into the details?
Right. So those of you who listened last week when we chose this book will know that I'm actually pretty familiar with A Woman in Black already. Like, I hadn't experienced it in the original format of reading it as a book, but I've experienced both its main adaptations. I saw the play, and it was, for those of you who do not know, the second longest running West End show in history. Duncan, you've seen the number one.
Yep, Mousetrap.
Longest running show, Agatha Christie's The Mousetrap, and you're not allowed to tell us the ending.
That's what they asked me to do, and I keep my word.
I can tell you, the cast of A Woman in Black gave me no promise. I caught it as it was touring, basically immediately after the show had ended. It's no longer running in London. And I caught them as they came to Cambridge. And I had an amazing time. I did not think that a play could be scary. But my word, that play was really scary. And there's a really special place in my heart for the film adaptation starring Daniel Radcliffe. I think it's pretty good. I'd say it's, you know, it's like a 7 out of 10 movie. You know, it's like, well, it's not perfect, but it really does what it says in the tin. It's spooky, there are some genuine scares, and I feel like Daniel Radcliffe's understated acting was a great next step for him after doing Harry Potter. And he wasn't doing, like, his kind of crazy manic films, like, you know, Swiss Army Man and the weird Al Yankovic story.
Have you ever seen Guns Akimbo? God, that's a fun film.
I've not, but you get exactly. Like, he has a niche now, which is boards to the wall stuff. This was before that. He was just like, we need a pale, little, sad man. I know exactly the boy we need. Anyway, I think he's pretty good in the movie. It's an understated, but effective delivery. So, I really like the story, as I've seen it in adaptation. And I was really intrigued because this book has a firm reputation. I've had it been told to me that it is one of the scariest books ever. And that is a goddamn lie, or at least an exaggeration by a true coward.
Wow, those are some strong words. I don't know if I feel quite as passionately as you do, but I certainly think I'm in a similar place. I haven't seen the stage play, want to put that out there, but I have seen the film and I had several kind of expectations going in.
Yeah.
There were some things the original book does that I did like more in terms of the overall plot and thematically kind of making a bit more sense. But there was also just the experience of reading this book was almost a bit too leisurely and a bit too long on the build-up. So although there were these kind of moments of, oh, well, that's creepy, there were also quite a few moments where I was just like, this is just a Sunday afternoon.
Yep.
I'm sure I'm meant to be feeling a vibe or a tone or like a sense of creepiness eeping in, but you're not doing that. I'm just in a pleasant English village. I'm not creeped out yet.
Something which I only sort of realised quite late in the game is, you know, I mentioned last time that I was under the impression that this was a much older book than it is, and there's a reason for that. It's written in the style of a Victorian or Edwardian ghost story. It's written in the 80s, which means it's a pastiche. Duncan, you love talking about pastiches. What Susan Hill is doing is she's aping the style of the Jameses, especially M.R. James. These are two brothers who were great ghost story writers. One of them, M.R. James, was a professor at Cambridge, and he was very famous amongst his students for telling ghost stories. And then he started writing them down, and he was a great writer of short, scary ghost stories.
I like how you really emphasise the short, scary. Because this isn't a long book.
Yeah.
But it definitely felt like, for me at places, it went on a bit too long for what it was trying to deliver.
Right. So, really quickly, we can take you through this book. Because there's very little to it. Granted, it's not a long book. You know, it's not even anywhere near as long as, like, there's Red Sonja Unchained, Red Sonja Unbound. What was it called again?
Red Sonja Consumed?
Consumed, right. That, yeah. It's nowhere near as long as, say, Red Sonja Consumed, which is another pastiche work, which we said is, like, too long in the tooth. And yet, here's what happens in the book. A middle-aged man who has remarried and has stepsons hears them telling ghost stories and is very put off by this because he has had a ghost story of his own, but he can't share it because he's too paralyzed by the dread and fear and loss that it invokes in him. But to exercise himself of this, he decides that he's going to write it down and tell it as his own story, not to share it with anyone, but just to get it off his chest. And then he tells this story. He was a happy-go-lucky young attorney. Lawyer from London. He's at a firm, and they say, you need to go to the countryside, because one of our clients has just died. Make an appearance at her funeral, collect the paperwork that's at her house, sort it all out, and that'll be all. And he goes, absolutely, boss, no problem at all. I have literally no problems in my life. I'm very happy. I have a fiancé. He goes there, he goes to the funeral of this old, sad woman, and what of that? There's a woman in the back row, but when he looks back to see her a second time, she's not there. And everyone else in the village is very confused when he mentions that he saw a woman, and actually, they seem a little upset. He goes to this house, he sees a woman in black staring at him, and he's like, huh, it must be a ghost. He puts it together immediately, starts collecting papers, hears like weird noises in the night, and is like a little bit afraid. Goes back to the house on one more occasion, collects all the papers, has a slightly frightening experience of hearing a rocking chair going up and says like, huh, rocking chair's rocking and no one's in it. And then the next day comes and he goes home.
Yes, but years later, after he was happily married to his first wife and had a little baby boy, they went to the fair, and his wife and the baby went on a little pony trap for a ride round the fairground. What was that? A ghostly image of a woman in black steps out in front of the horse, spooking the animal and causing it to career off and crash, killing his wife and child. The end.
So the whole point of the entire book is, a man sees a woman in black, a ghost, and this ghost, upon being seen, haunts him. You know, she selects him to die. And as part of the story, this guy slowly figures out the nature, the identity of the ghost, and then subsequently, why she's upset, why she's continuing to haunt, He has no actual interactions with the ghost. He only ever sees her or hears her. But he's never, like, actually menaced by the ghost. There's no spooky Japanese ghost who, like, rushes at the camera, which is something that happens in, funnily enough, you know, it happens in the movie, because the movie's more straightforwardly a bit of a fright fest. But actually, it even happens in the play. You know, in the play, Duncan, the terrifying thing about it is that, like, they will turn the stage completely black, and then you just have a man walking around with a lantern, staring from place to place, and you're like, oh my god, where is she? Where's the woman in black? Is she there? What's that sound? Is that her moving around? And they will just let it build up this tension, and then maybe the woman's there, and maybe she isn't, but there's one scene where he's holding the lantern, and he's looking out over the audience, and then slowly, out of the total darkness of the stage, the pale face of a woman slides into the light, and he turns his head, and he faces her, and then she rushes at him until they're like nose to nose, and she screams, and Duncan, it's terrifying! And nothing remotely like that happens in the book. He just sees a woman, and then after he's seen her like four separate times from a distance, someone says, oh, by the way, whenever the woman in black is seen, a child dies. This is dropped like a rock right towards the end.
And it kind of plays into the theme of the ghost. So for those that don't know the plot, the sort of the story behind the woman in black that we get revealed through Arthur's investigations of the papers and the private letters is that the woman in black is the sister of the old lady that recently died. And we get shown that she had a child out of wedlock. The scandal. And after some back and forth, what was to happen, this woman's sister said, I'll adopt the child, we'll treat it as our own. You can come and live with us, but we must make it absolutely clear that for all intents and purposes, the child is mine, and they must never know you're their mother. For shame. So, years pass, the woman in black gets quite upset and wants to basically run away with her child. I keep calling her the woman in black. The actual character's name is it Janet?
Yeah.
Yeah. She was planning to run away with the child, but tragedy strikes. And the child, while on a pony cart being taken across the marshland, I believe the horse is spooked, the cart gets overturned or stuck in the mud, and the child sadly drowns. And that's it. And obviously she's very upset, and she grieves, and she dies shortly thereafter.
She goes insane.
And then she starts haunting.
So, here's the deal, right? There's a reason why aspects of the story really stuck out to people, because, you know, the sense of loss and mania that comes along with it is really felt by the idea of the woman in black. It's very evocative. It's obvious why people are like, yes, we want to take this character and make something of it. But it's noteworthy to me what changes both of the main adaptations have made. And I've said two so far. There are technically three, because the Woman in Black movie from 2012 actually got a sequel like 2 years later. The Woman in Black, The Angel of Death, which is garbage. And not for nothing, it's famously extraordinarily bad. Not for nothing, guess who one of the writers of The Woman in Black 2 is?
Oh, I actually have no idea. Is it someone that we've...
Susan Hill.
No.
Yeah. They were like, oh, we made a really, like, literally the most successful British horror movie since, I don't know, 28 Days Later. It's astoundingly successful. Let's get the original author back. Obviously, she invented the character. She has the magic touch. Oh no, the movie's extraordinarily bad because he's shit at writing. I haven't seen it. I can't make those judgments. And I've literally only read one book by her, but I'm extraordinarily soured against her.
Right. Let's go over some of the issues here, which I think kind of stopped me kind of really getting into this and feeling this story. While the idea of this ghost who doesn't go after you, you know, but it goes after your children. Obviously, if you're a parent, I'm not. I can see where that extra level of fear, you know, it's they're going to attack you know, something innocent. It's not trying to invoke like death and pain upon you, but it's trying to make you suffer the loss that the ghost suffered. There's a cool idea here.
And the unbridled rage of it, the ghost's sense of injustice is so strong that she'll strike out at, as you said, Duncan, the very innocent. If I can't have one, neither can you. That's it's tragic. It's scary.
I know, and that's good. That's emotional. That's charged. Where I think this book kind of falls down is that where you've got this emotionally charged ghost, you don't have a very emotionally charged protagonist.
Absolutely.
And
not.
One thing that I kept thinking about in this story, and I'm not well read in horror, so I feel like an absolute basic hack for bringing this person's name up, but it's often noted that one Stephen King does something quite well, and that's write fear. He knows how to describe how a character is feeling afraid, even if the thing they're afraid of can range from genuinely scary to goofy as all hell.
Yeah.
And Arthur Kipp in this book never seems afraid. Not deeply. He seems perplexed, intrigued, a little bit solemn. But I don't think we ever get that fear from the character. And because he's not feeling that fear, I'm not feeling that fear. I'm not brought into the same place as I feel like it could be.
Yes, there's definitely some truth to that. You know, like, if a character is, like, irreverent, will never be afraid of the consequence they're going to face. Like, if a character, like, laughs in the face of danger, well, you know what, I'm not inclined to be that afraid. I do know what Susan Hill is going for here. She's trying to create dramatic irony. She's trying to punish this sense of the lack of fear. You know, if you were more wary, you wouldn't be experiencing this danger. You know, you wouldn't be imperiling yourself. So right before this episode, Duncan, I had half an hour to spare, so I sat down and I read an M.R. James story. I googled, what's the best M.R. James story? And the answer seemed to be, Whistle and I'll Come for You, My Lad. So I read it. It took 34 minutes. It's not long. And it was a very good story. And guess what? It's about a professor from Cambridge. So, you know, he's writing, you know, it's true to life. And he writes a story about this guy who doesn't believe in ghosts and is frankly quite brazen about it, accidentally stealing like a haunted relic. And it takes him a really long time to sort of catch on to the fact that he's being haunted. Weird stuff keeps happening, but he keeps justifying it to himself because that raises the tension. He's not noticing the omens. He's creating more problems. He always finds a rationalization, and then it's too late. He ignored the warnings, and now it's time to be punished because the ghost is in the room with you. And you know, I'm not going to say that the M.R. James story was scary, but it was dramatic and it was exciting. Like, I was like, okay, yes, I'm feeling the excitement. The ghost is getting closer. When's it going to happen? What's the nature of the ghost? And it was a very satisfying conclusion. Short read, brief, but I've read a ghost story and I feel like I got everything that I paid for, which was nothing because of Project Gutenberg Canada.
Well, I'm glad you got that. And that's why I kind of felt here. That's why I was sort of maybe expecting a bit more. So I'm glad you kind of found it somewhere else. I'm not going to lie, a bit of me slightly annoyed because I was very much on the edge of selecting that story.
Ah.
The follow-up. How could you, Geordie? I'll have to find something else now. So what then do you think is very specific? Do you think it's the fact that Arthur Kipp, although he has this kind of calm, irreverence. There we go. That's the language. Irreverence, although he has that kind of attitude, is it taken maybe a step too far, or there's not sufficient kind of dramatic irony? Because genuinely, the bits in this book, really, I almost found quite funny. The scene, the first appearance of the woman in black, we have where Arthur's at in the church and they're doing the last rites for the deceased, yep. And he notices her at the back, and his first instinct is, oh, there's a pale and gaunt old lady. Perhaps I'll go up to her and offer her my arm.
I quite liked that scene. I felt like that scene was very promising because it was that first stage. There's this, I remember reading in a RPG book, actually, called Mothership, which is a game about horror, and it has rules for presenting horror, and it talks about the threshold. You know, the characters have to cross the threshold, and it's not merely the fact that, yes, they've stepped into the world of danger and adventure. That happens in any hero's journey. It's the breaking of the threshold. You snapped the seal. You crossed the line, and you will suffer the consequences of that. This is the moment of crossing the line. He looks back, and he sees the woman. And if you know the story already, you know, okay, he's sealed his fate right now. If you're reading it for the first time, you don't know that. The tension has to grow. The issue is, Arthur Kipps never actually gets that frightened, and there's never really much sense that he's actually in danger. Even if you don't know the woman in black doesn't kill adults, you never actually get the sense of, yes, she's coming for you.
I think part of this, and this is something that was changed in the film adaptation, is that during the events of the haunting, the main section of the book, Arthur's yet to have a child.
Right.
It's all quite still speculative. You know, even when he hears that, he drops on you, a child always dies. There's this sort of sense of Arthur's just like, not my issue at the moment.
Yeah, I don't have a kid.
Off I go.
I'm immune. So this is obviously happening because she wants it to be a twist. That's what she's after. We know from the start that this dude is badly affected by his encounter with a ghost. So the question you have is, all right, where is that going to, what's going to change in his life? How is it going to affect him? And when you discover it doesn't affect, it only hurts children, you're like, well, then he's fine, right? And that's the twist, that his, that he's not safe. And this is supposed to be the great horror of it, which is the horror follows him home. The idea of the horror coming with you was really innovative in 1870. Susan Hill's great innovation to this ghost story is, oh, the ghost can move around. You know who came up with the idea that the ghost can move around? It was Bram Stoker.
I can't speak to the historical context. I'm sure we can maybe find someone's going to go actually.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. I'm just being a bit. The point is that it's not.
But no,
it's
I know what you mean. Popularise these tropes and these ideas.
It's not a big twist. It's not effective. Who cares? Actually, you know what? It is a bit effective because actually that scene is like, oh yeah, this is sad. But it's not scary.
Yeah, it's sad. It's tragic. But you're right, it's not scary. One of the things I kind of have for this scene is that we don't get to know the two characters that die, we don't get to know them.
No.
We don't have a sort of personal connection. And also, we don't get a lot of time. It's not like Arthur's going through this story going, I can't wait to get back to my pregnant wife, or I can't wait to start my family.
Right.
It's sort of a move. We don't really know how much this impacts him until you sort of look back at the opening chapter and go, oh, this is the Great Haunting. But even then, I have to say, I know it's a terrible tragedy that befalls this character, but in the opening section, it's basically, and I moved on, and I remarried, and now I have some lovely stepchildren.
I understand why you're saying that. I personally don't think that's quite fair, because he's obviously extremely affected. And I feel like the opening chapter is actually pretty good. It's boring and mundane in a way that's entertaining enough, you know? It really is capturing a sort of Dickensian atmosphere, because boy does Susan Hill wish she was writing like Dickens, you know, presenting London as this smog-filled monstrosity, and it's only a pity that she doesn't have Dickens's, you know, wit and ability to create these interesting and striking imaginative characters. And, you know, he's like strong prose and I wouldn't say he's an effective storyteller, because most of his stories are legitimately too long because of the format he was writing in. And it's also just the one of a problem, which is that Dickens is a really great writer and she's shit. That's also a bit of a problem.
Right. Let's Let's start with just the outright bashing. Let's talk about some of the other things, though, because you talk about then, you know, Jim Capaldi and Dickens, great characters. One of the real things that I think also dragged this book down is that the times when we're not in the haunting zone, when it's not about Arthur interacting with the ghost, it's Arthur going about this sort of small rural community. And I'm going to tell you now, Geordie, the innkeeper, the innkeeper's wife, the he goes along to an auction and he goes into, and there's wheels of cheese, and I don't know what the vibe this community was going to give, but it was neither, how do I put it? It was neither Wicker Man creepy or like, outsider here.
Good choice.
Like, it actually just struck me as, and maybe there's something to be said to the fact that, you know, I live in the south of jolly old England, but pretty normal. Like, yeah, this is what people do. Like, it was completely benign to the point of forgettability and boring. I wasn't really engaging with any particular emotion during the sort of the downtime. Just was happening.
It didn't feel like there was a lot of drama. Legitimately, the only bit that I even found remotely compelling was he, like, goes to a really fancy house and he, like, bikes there. And he, like, this is kind of funny. He, like, hides the bike because he doesn't want them to know that he had to ride his bike to get there. So they're like, oh, shall we call for your cab? And he says, no, I must take the air. And then he, like, goes to where he hid his bike. That was pretty entertaining. I like that.
Genuinely, the best side character in this story is the dog called Spider. Not in the film adaptation, and I'm not going to lie. Only thing in this book where I went, oh, I wish that made it over.
She's there.
Is she?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I am not remembering this film right.
Spider is only important in this book because she represents one of the few moments of actual, like, drama and danger, because she almost drowns in the bog and Arthur, like, saves her. That scene doesn't happen in the book because there's a different scene of drowning, almost drowning, which is like, well, let's, you know what? Duncan, I feel like we should talk about the movie and the many adaptational changes it made.
I'm down for that. So obviously we referenced the fact that the film was a bit more of a fright fest, the scares are much more in your face.
Yeah.
I would say there are three major changes that super influence, that sort of changed my experience of the film. Number one is the fact that the ghost in the film adaptation is much more aggressive.
Yes.
And coming for the kids. And that's made very clear early on. Like, this is a ghost that is slaughtering this community's next generation. No child is making it to adulthood in this town.
Right. It's she has a serious body count. I watched it fairly recently. I reckon that she has a body count of, like, obviously there's, like, probably a lot more in the past that are hinted at. I'm gonna say 1, 2, 7 kids. 7 kids are killed in this movie.
It's intense, and I feel one of the aspects of the community, we talked about it being quite benign in the book, this village community, but one of the sense you get in the village in the film adaptation is the sense that they are all actively played and having their lives ruined by the fact that all their kids are being killed. And there's this sort of sadness and frustration that the whole town is constantly fearing. Like, the town folk are in fear of this ghost.
It's sort of like an early scene in Dracula. Like, they're like, don't go to Castle Dracula because bad stuff will happen to you. And of course, the hero ignores them and, you know, he presses on and therefore invokes the danger. The difference is that Arthur's transgression has repeated consequences. The fact that he's going to this house repeatedly, he goes there on 3 occasions, means that he is causing the death of children. He's responsible for this. And as he remains skeptical, Arthur in the book, as I alluded to earlier, he actually decides that she is a ghost extraordinarily early. He's very willing to accept the presence of a ghost. So the moment he sees it the second time, he's like, must be a ghost. Oh, well. And then moves along. That's why we say he's so blasé. Arthur in the movie, his incredulity is this great sin. As he slowly starts to realize, oh no, something really is here, he bears the responsibility for his own ignorance and the evil that he's done. And then he has a character arc. This arc, the bomb from the book, did not have a character arc, because in the movie he's like, oh, I've got to do something about this. I'm going to have to try and find resolution. The Arthur Gibbs is like, I got my papers. I'm gone. This is not my problem anymore.
That was the biggest surprise to me reading the original book, is that there is no plot arc for Arthur trying to resolve the haunting. And I thought that was like going to be the whole point of like the latter third. So in the film adaptation, we mentioned this whole... Sorry, we mentioned earlier that one of the reasons that the woman that is haunting people, she's filled with so much rage, is that she feels like she was denied her child in life. She never got to experience that joy. So Arthur, in the film adaptation, goes on this whole quest to like reunite their bodies in the hopes this will mean that they're together again in death, and that will appease the angry spirit.
And he puts life on the line. You know, he's, even though he's like this, he's not a dramatic, striking hero, he goes out of his way. He risks his life to do this by going into the marsh. There is a scene which is, every time I see it, very ridiculous. I like the introduction to the scene, because he says, we have to get the boy, we have to pull up the carriage. And the local man who he's been working with says, oh, but they tried to do that years ago, and it's too far down in the mud. And Arthur says, ah, but you have something they don't, because now it's the Edwardian age, and this dude has a car. So they hitch the car to the carriage, who's buried under all this muck, and they, like, reverse the car out and pull up the carriage, and you go to yourself, that has to be, like, 50 tons of force sitting on top of that carriage, right? Water is really heavy.
Not just water, muddy marsh water.
Sticky,
and the fact that this car is on soft ground. If, to be brutally honest, there would be a degree of, like, incredulity within me if that scene had a tank.
Yeah, I was going to say,
I'm not sure it's going to pull it off.
Yep. And it's like a, it's a 1912 car. It's for Thomas Flyer. Anyway, it's fine. Obviously, it's a little nitpick. It's silly, but it's the point is, and this is the real difference, right? Arthur empathizes with the ghost over the course, just like in the book. He comes to understand the ghost, and he feels for her, because in the movie, Arthur is not engaged. He's a widower. His wife died in childbirth, giving birth to his son, a very sad little boy. Arthur is trying to provide for his son. He's an attorney, but in this book, his boss isn't just like somewhat rude. He's a genuine asshole, and his work is on the line. That means he has to do this job, even though he knows there might be danger in it, because he's going to lose his job and he won't be able to provide for his son. He has reasons to go on the adventure. And most importantly, having experienced loss, and then knowing that his own son, who is coming to the village, coming into range of the ghost, not only does he feel for the ghost, and does he want to bring her closure because he himself is unable to achieve closure, he has a reason, he has a ticking clock. When the train arrives, my son will be imperiled.
It certainly adds a lot of drama. And it really kind of gives you the sense of like why Arthur's here, why he's invested, and why he can't just walk away.
So,
can I so just take a moment to read from the book, just to show the true contrast of this, what we're getting across in the adaptation, which we really enjoyed. In the book, Arthur actually says these words: "Her bitterness was understandable. The wickedness that led her to take away other women's children because she had lost her own. Understandable too, but not forgivable. There was nothing anyone could do to help her, except perhaps pray." There we go, that's the extent of his plans and operations in the book.
Thoughts and prayers for the woman in black. Oh man, I'll go to the final point, because we're talking about the adaptation. As we said before, he recovers the body of the deceased son, and he lays him like in his not in his bed, they put him in the coffin with her. They dig up Janet, they put the boy in the coffin, they bury it, and then he sets up his room with like all his creepy toys, and the woman in black appears and like confronts him one last time, gives him a good spook, and then they leave. And the final difference, the final change, is that much like in the book and much like in the play, because the play is much truer to it's much truer to the book than the film, the woman in black does not forgive. She does not get over. She can't move past her hatred. And she possesses the little boy, his son, makes him walk onto the railroad tracks. The one difference is that Daniel Radcliffe, Arthur Clip, jumps on the track to try and save his son, and they're both killed. And all the ghosts of the many, many slain children watch from the side as Arthur fruitlessly tries to save his son. Do you remember the last change, Duncan?
Yes. We get a very interesting final note. Sort of the uplifting point of the film is that after the train comes by, we get a scene of Arthur and his son apparently unharmed, and his son is looking in a different direction to Arthur and goes, who's that woman, Daddy?
Yes.
And Daniel Radcliffe turns around and is like, oh, that's your mother. And then they all hand in hand walk off to heaven.
Well, maybe. I think they probably don't go to heaven. I think they are probably trapped in misty ghostland forever together. But they're together. You know, that's the point. Arthur, despite his failure, has one last bittersweet reward, which is that he's returned to his darling wife, and she is reunited with a son who she never knew. She gets what Woman in Black never did. And then, of course, finally, the Woman in Black is there on the platform, and then she turns to the camera, and then it's over.
I will say, there is something, like, when I remember watching that in the film for the first time, I just remember thinking, oh gosh, this ghost is such an asshole.
Yes, like, she's a real...
You can tell that Daniel Radcliffe is trying really hard here to be empathetic, understanding, and, like, you know, meet you halfway. Whereas I do feel in the book, at least I can go, yeah, fair play, that guy did kind of flip you off. Like, you know, he knew what the curse was. You know, the ground rules were set. I get where you're coming from.
Can I tell you something about the ending of the play? Because I think it has... this is probably what led to the movie making a lot more changes.
Go ahead.
The play is much closer to the book. You know, it has a cast of just three people, I think. Like, Arthur Kipps, one actor who plays different roles, but he's every other man in the book. And then the woman in black, who stands at the back, being spooky, and sometimes menacing Arthur. Now, here's the trick. After the play is basically over, you have the exact scene from the book. He has his wife, his little baby son is going on a railroad, is going on a carriage ride. The woman shows up and spooks the horse, and he's like, no! And his family dies. And then a weird scene happens, because the other actor shows up and says, I thought you did a pretty good job. And he's just like, well, I really tried to express, you know, my devotion and my fear all in one place, and I needed to get it out of my system. And you realize, oh, what I've been watching is a play. Like, on stage, the whole show was a play within a play. We weren't experiencing the ghost story firsthand. We were watching a simulacrum. These were actors doing their parts. And then the other actor says, and I really liked, you know, the new actress you got. It's a pity the old one couldn't make it. And Arthur Kipps, who is in the narrative of the play, himself, playing himself as a character. And he says, what do you mean? So it's like, well, the woman who's been standing over the play in the background, when did you hire her? And then they hear the sound of a rocking chair. And suddenly, Arthur Kipps realizes She's here. She's been watching and she's been following him on the stage as he has like made this mocking depiction of his story. She was there, and he runs off terrified, and the lighting of the stage slowly changes, and then there she is at the back, standing, staring as everything else goes back black, but the spotlight hangs on her glowing face in the dark, just watching dead into your soul. And then the play ends, and it's haunting.
It sounds it. Flippin' hell. Firstly, amazing description.
Thank
Secondly,
you, Jonathan.
I don't know if I'll be able to watch this play.
Your actions, I don't know if you can.
I'm going to level with you. You've scared me more in that description than I felt reading this damn book.
Genuinely, I think the play might be the reason anyone discusses this book. Someone said, hey, there's this ghost story. I feel like this could be adapted pretty well. Started a play, and they were like, let's make it, like, properly scary. People got scared by it, and they were like, oh, that was a scary play, I liked it. And then they played it for, like, 50 years, and now it's over. And I think that's the reason why we're discussing it at all. There's no reason to remember this.
And to be quite brutally honest and fair, no one really does bring up the book to me. This is something that people do talk about the play, or people, to be honest, a lot of people know the Daniel Radcliffe film, because I think it got a lot of, you know, not just praise for the film, but it got a lot of media coverage because it was one of his first things coming off Harry Potter, the biggest thing at the time.
That's true.
Ever. So that's where people kind of have that familiarity. Going back to this original text, I had such high hopes for A Chilling Ghost Story, and I don't want to say I wasn't impacted at all, but that's because my bar's really low and I'm very easily scared. And even for me, it was almost like whenever I felt like I was going to find fear in this story, the story itself calmed me with the main character.
Let's say some nice things about this book. Some of the descriptions of landscapes were okay.
Oh, is it my turn? Let me think. I like having a dog. The dog was the I did enjoy, from the bit the dog was introduced, I did enjoy that more than the previous bit.
I like the fact that the dog is introduced and it's therefore obviously imperiled, and you go, oh no, what about the dog? And the dog is fine. That's nice.
It is nice. I like, I did genuinely find it a little bit funny in the opening scene, knowing that the ghost is a ghost story I'm reading, when he was like, I should go and offer that kindly old lady my arm. And I do...
I'll say this. I liked the initial description of the woman in black. You know, before he realizes she's a ghost, he describes her in this, like, exacting manner. And you know what? I really liked it, about describing how she's like, she is a young woman, and yet she seems racked, maybe by some terrible illness. And she has he describes, like, her skinniness in a sort of unsettling way. That was actually, that was a good description.
I like how this book has made me Arthur Kipp. Because now I stand here treating it with a laissez-faire attitude, lulling me into a sense, the same sense of the character. So maybe in that way I am embodying the protagonist very well.
I like the fact that she made a point of the fact that an Edwardian man recognises the old-fashionedness of the Victorian house and the Victorian clothing that she's wearing. And he draws a contrast of this himself, creating a distinction of two great distinct eras, even though I myself, you know, I don't think of these as especially different, but they certainly would have. There's no scene of a car being used to pull the cart from the mud as a demonstration of the changing times, but Arthur Kipps uses a flashlight, and you go, oh, right, yeah. In a movie, he's carrying candles around everywhere, but because they want to evoke that spooky Victorian vibe. But no, he is, he's a modern man.
See, I really want to close it off. I suppose I really do appreciate that what we get at the end is succinct, and we do get a moment for this character in the very, very final pages. And I know I've made a lot out of him not acting scared, but he doesn't feel the fear. But we do finally get, when he has to bear witness to the death of his son and the death of his wife, we kind of see that it's not fear, it's just the complete brokenness. I like the fact this is a very line near the very end of the book. He's witnessed the death of his son and his wife in this sort of carriage crash. And he goes, "This time there was no mercy. Loss of consciousness. I was forced to live through it all. Every minute and then every day thereafter. For 10 long months." I like it that he suffers. It's not about him being scared. It's about him truly suffering loss. And that did resonate, not nearly as hard as I was hoping it to, but it was there.
I agree.
And that's the point.
Yes, I do agree with that to a certain extent. The point is that Arthur Kipps doesn't feel this fear during the narrative because Susan Hill knows that the boot hasn't fallen yet. She lets him stay innocent and naive so that you can have that bam, that hit at the end. And unfortunately, that makes the rest of the story suffer. So she's holding it all back for one last hit. It just doesn't hit hard enough. Because I spent the rest of the book not being afraid and frankly being bored. You want to have the sense of characters have lived through something terrifying and now they have to live with it. Listen to the Magnus Archives. Every single episode of that is a short story, and almost all of them are an account being delivered by someone who's lived through a ghost story or an encounter with a weird monster or a coffin that has what letters scratched onto it. And almost all of them are like, I can never be the same because I've been so horrified by this and it affects everything that I do from now on. And any given episode of that show is going to be better than reading this book.
I mean, I was about to say sad but true, but it's not sad, it's simply true. The Magnus Archives is brilliant.
How far into it have you gotten now, Dunk?
Alas, not very far. I'm still only 30-odd episodes in.
Mm.
But even those first 30, there's been so many bangers. It really is an incredible experience.
You got to, Duncan, have you figured out the plot?
Have I figured out the plot of the Magnus Archives?
Did you know that there is a plot?
I'm vaguely aware that there has been a few pieces together. Something is definitely off with... They've brought up... Oh, sorry, just talk about the Magnus Archives. It's the story of this archivist collecting these tales of horror and making a record of them for the Magnus Institute, which sort of investigates these issues.
Yeah.
And there definitely it's been revealed that something's off with the Institute. There are certain players that the Institute itself is either trying to protect or is in service to. And that I'm start this story thinking that that the Magnus Institute is the undebatable good guys. And I think it's starting to turn that maybe not everyone here is.
Well, we shall see. Duncan, I encourage you to keep going because I really love the series. I'm currently listening to the latest season of its like second series and I'm enjoying that. But I have a really warm feeling in my heart when I go back to the memory of listening to weekly releases and like the story slowly emerging. And it's genuinely so impressive that series can exist. The guy who wrote those stories, Jonathan Sims, like his job wasn't he like he's the first of all he's the main actor as well, which is very demanding. So not only did he have to write legitimately hundreds of horror stories, obviously short fiction, but still he had to come up with all these ideas and actually sit down and write them, which is hard, and then he had to act them out and deliver them, and then folded into this like this gigantic conspiracy web story that emerges over time. I'm not going to go out and say that like any given episode is like amazing, because I don't find that many of them like to be genuinely scary, but they are very compelling, and it fits together in an astounding way, considering its scope.
It's definitely one of those pieces, and we've explored some very tentpoles of horror on this podcast in terms of particularly short fiction. You know, we went back and we looked at H.P. Lovecraft, and you know, I think we said quite fairly, you know, we're not super impressed. And while we've read some really great modern works, The Worm and His Kings was outstanding, there is something to the volume, regular release, and just general standard of quality in the Magnus Archives, which, although I, being not a massive horror person, can't quite munch my way through more than one a day a week, you know, I need a cool down period, it's so impressive to bear witness. And to be brutally honest with you, I almost feel like it, whenever I listen to it, I think to myself, gosh, this should be more famous than it is. Not that it's not popular, but I'm like, this should be in just a more general level of cultural zeitgeist. I think this is so well done.
I mean, I agree that it's extremely well known and successful for what it is, which is like a independent British podcast, and it's now like a big network. But yes, Duncan, I understand exactly what you mean. I think we should press towards final thoughts. This is a short episode because there's very little to say about this book. It's a ghost story which isn't scary.
And there you have it. If you have never seen any version or experienced any version of The Woman in Black, I think it's come across quite clearly.
This is the worst one.
Absolutely. If someone came up to me and said, I've heard about The Woman in Black, like, should I read the book first? I'll be like, to be honest, no. If you're lucky enough that you can see the stage adaptation, you know, in your area, in a good time frame, absolutely, from what you've told me, Geordie, I would want to go and do that. I want to go and do that. But I think the Daniel Radcliffe film is a pretty good piece of horror media. You're not really getting a bad experience with it. I have heard in my little bit of research for this episode that there is apparently some old 1980s BBC adaptation, but I've not really managed, you know, I haven't seen much of it, but the few people that have claim it's amazing. I'll leave it to them to protest such things.
I'm going to jump in right here and say that I just googled it because I was interested. It's back. The play is back. You know, there are venues across the UK where it's being performed. Duncan, if we want to go to see it together, we can have a little reunion in Brighton and we can go to the Theatre Royal. Did you ever go to the Theatre Royal when we were at the uni?
Oh, I've been to the Theatre Royal. I saw Ian McKellen on that stage. Oh. One of my favourite experiences. He was doing his 80th year, 80 shows for his 80th year. Absolute amazing man that he was, and it was just one of those sort of,
was he in?
I'm gonna sit here on the middle of the stage in an armchair and tell you about my life, and it was incredible.
Wow, that genuinely sounds really great. So yeah, it shows through November through January of this year, well, January of next year, but you know what I mean.
So exciting. Well, I think that kind of brings an end on The Woman in Black. Obviously, if you strongly disagree with our opinions, do let us know. I can potentially imagine someone who perhaps did experience this first, maybe getting a bit more of a kick out of it, not knowing where it was going. So if that was you, tell us what that experience is like, or if you just found this scarier or better than we're claiming, maybe we missed the point, maybe there's some social commentary that just flew over our heads. Let us know. The best place, as always, is on our Instagram, Is This Just Fantasy podcast. You can also catch us on our Gmail if you want to send a bit of a longer message at itsfantasypodcast@gmail.com, and we're also on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy.
Thank you, Duncan. My recommendation is to read an M.R. James story or any, like, don't go to the source. If you want to read an Edwardian ghost story, find an Edwardian ghost story. Like, don't read this simulacrum. It's a pastiche, and it's not an especially good one. Duncan, do you have any recommendations for what I should be reading quite soon?
That is a great question, Geordie. Now, as Halloween rolls around, there are some extra tidbits and traditions that we must honour. So I do want to bring to attention, during this October month of spooks and scares, we shall be revisiting Berserk, covering the next arc, which I believe is called, in a non-Star Wars way, the Millennium Falcon arc. Genuinely?
Technically speaking, we've already been reading the Millennium Falcon arc. The next bit is... we've done Holy Evil War. No, maybe the next bit is Millennium Falcon, yeah.
So, do come up to pace and join us for that one. But hopefully we will squeeze in another little extra horror. And Jordy, you've really...
we should do, it's...
I know we should do, but you've really done me in. Because you've talked about the two things that I was genuinely looking at to explore in the next episode.
Well, we can do it.
Well, you brought up M.R. James, who was very much all short stories, punchy ghosts. That would be great. And I will tell you now, I did go back and re-listen to the first sort of three episodes of the Magnus Archives, thinking, hang on, is that magic? Is that a...
okay, first of all, yes, the main characters definitely would count as fantasy, but we're not going to do a podcast about a podcast. That would be too much. Duncan, I know it's not my choice to, it's not my decision to make, but if you were interested in doing, like, the Magnus Archives, you know, the writer behind it, Jonathan Sims, he wrote a book.
Has he now? I did not know that.
Yeah, it's called Seven Stories, but stories with an E and a Y, you know, like a building.
That sounds good. Geordie, if you...
I don't know. I've no idea. I've never heard any review of it.
Well, maybe it's time that we did one. I was really struggling, so I love that recommendation. So we're going to do it.
It's not a recommendation. I literally have no idea anything about it. But I really like the way that this has come about, because this is the most unplanned any of our decisions we've ever done on this podcast. I have genuinely in the past looked at my bookshelf and gone, that one. But this takes the biscuit.
So unplanned that I actually got the name of the book wrong. It's 13 Stories. So, you know, 7, 13, close enough.
So there you have it, people. We will be covering
13 Stories.
By
Jonathan Sims.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm genuinely very intrigued by this, and I will see you next time, Duncan. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
Dead Man Nicol. We've been over this.